The year is 1969. The place is the Swedish small town called Falun. At the hospital, four young boys have been molested by a man in the staff. A man who was also a patient in the local psychiatric facility. One of the boys was a patient of the pediatric ward. He was raped and strangled. But what no one knew was that the 19-year-old young man Sture Bergvall, who committed these repulsive crimes, would in years be known all over Sweden by the name of Thomas Quick. Thomas was admitted to Sanders, a hospital for the criminally insane. He was diagnosed with pedophilia, sadistic pedophilia, by the chief of the hospital. But with further investigation, he was declared to have an immature personality and antisocial personality disorder. He was treated from the years 1970 to 77. But already in 1971, he was released on a trial basis. He attended a community college in Jokkmokk, where he strangled a classmate as a result of a fight. According to the victim in question, Quick behaved like an animal. His voice turned coarse and forceful, and his facial expressions became grotesque. The incident was never reported to the police, however. In 1973, Quick went home with an acquaintance he had met at a gay club. Without provocation, Quick hit the man in the head with a frying pan and stabbed him repeatedly. He left the man for dead in his apartment and brought the knife with him from the scene. Luckily, the man was not dead and managed to call the ambulance, who arrived in time to save him from bleeding out. Quick was arrested soon after, but because of the fact that he was undergoing treatment, he wasn't charged with this crime. Something that follows Thomas Quick throughout all this is his inclination towards young boys. In 1986, when he was 36, he met a boy which we will call M. M was 16 years old, and soon after they met, he would move in with a 20-year-older man and would become his accomplice in several crimes, among them an armed robbery where they held a family hostage. Quick showed off his sadistic tendencies by using a knife on the wall close by where their son was sleeping. Thomas Quick has later admitted that he planned on killing the boy, but he was too ugly. As a result of the robbery, Quick once again was admitted to Sanders Hospital with the diagnosis split personality disorder. The years went and they were starting to prepare him for release back into society. But instead, something new came to light. Thomas Quick admitted to the murder of Johan Asplund, an 11-year-old boy whose body was never found. He had disappeared on November 7th in 1980 from a nearby town called Sundsvall. Even though there was no physical evidence linking him to the case, his confession and his ability to give them details only the murderer could have known was enough to find him guilty. After the first confessions, more and more crimes were uncovered. He admitted over a period of a decade up to 30 murders from the years 1964 to the year of 1993. All over Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and Finland. And all over, people were shocked by the gruesome details. He told the police that he would take parts of the bodies with him from the scene of the crime and hide them. He didn't want to reveal the placement of the body parts so that he could keep them with his world of imagination. The first time he committed a murder was in 1964, when he was only 14 years old. He had gotten a ride from a homosexual man that in the past had taken him out to look for boys to have sex with. In Växjö, then Sture Bergvall found his first victim in the boy Thomas Blomgren. They were about the same age, but Thomas was smaller and shorter, which made it easier for him to control the smaller boy. Quick insists that he only wanted to have sex with him, but he screamed for help, something that witnesses have been able to collaborate. So he strangled him until he stopped breathing. He then stuffed the boy into his shed, and while doing so, he left a handprint of blood on the body. The first boy is where Thomas got his name from. Quick was his mother's maiden name. And hello, everyone. This has been an introduction to today's episode. I thought it would be interesting to have a sort of intro to today's episode, because it's almost Halloween, and I wanted to make it seem a little more ominous. Today, I have a guest as well, who have helped me write parts of this episode, or most of it, actually. The guest is not only a literary scholar, but also my sister. I'd like you all to welcome Sofia.
Hello.
Yes. And it has been very interesting to delve into this topic with you. You have done a lot of reading on it.
Yeah, there is a lot of books on this specific topic. And yeah, it's a very interesting topic, really. I am a bit of a true crime nerd, so this has been very interesting for me personally.
Yeah, Thomas Quick is one of the most famous cases in all of Swedish crime history. So it wouldn't be strange that it's an interesting case. So let's start with the beginning. Who was Thomas Quick?
I mean, Thomas Quick was a taken name, for starters. As you said in the intro, Thomas is from his first merger, and Quick is his mother's maiden name. He took this name in 92 or 93, I think, and it was soon after that he started to confess to murder.
Yeah, he wanted to protect his family, from what I gather. His real name is Sture Bergvall, which he has once again assumed recently, but he is most known as Thomas Quick. Yeah, it's quite uncontroversial that he is rather a nasty person. Most people who have come across him throughout the time, as we mentioned, have described him as a violent sadist, and he is also a known pedophile. So when people started to hear about his confessions, people were kind of inclined to believe him.
Yeah, I think even his brother actually was inclined to believe him. I think usually it's the family that says, oh no, he could never have done that. So when your own brother says, yeah, I knew that it was him, that holds a certain weight.
Yeah, and at the time, also in the 1990s, the sort of topic of serial killers was very sort of in vogue, so to speak. So a lot of people were inclined to believe that he had done these things. Because a lot of earlier serial killers, especially in America, even those who admitted their crimes weren't always believed, because people didn't think that these crimes could happen. But in the 1990s, the image of the serial killer had already been established. And of course, Thomas Quick fit this image pretty well.
Yeah, and when you discuss Thomas Quick, it's what you also have to discuss is the therapeutic sessions that he went through, and the kind of controversial memory exercises they did.
Yeah, we'll come to that later. There are some unconventional therapeutic methods that were used on Thomas. But first, let's start with why he is known as a serial killer, which is the murders. And the first murder he was convicted of, and the first murder that he confessed, was the murder of Johan Asplund in Sundsvall.
Johan Asplund, as you said, was an 11-year-old boy. and he disappeared in 1980. And the thing was that he just walked out the door on his way to school, and he never actually arrived at school. And so somewhere between his house and the school, he just vanished. He was abducted. And for a long time, this was a cold case. Like, there was no evidence. And the primary suspect was the mother's ex-boyfriend. The mother and the father all thought that he did it. So they were surprised when they heard that a man in Säter had confessed to this murder.
Yeah, and this family is also, they were very skeptical towards his confessions. And yeah, that's because, like, these kinds of murders are very atypical. If you look, like, most murders, it would be more typical to assume that it was someone
close that to knew the family.
Who your one was. Yes.
Yeah. And another thing is that usually when a case is being closed after a long time, usually you can see in the investigation that the actual murder was a part of the investigation.
Yes. And that was also one of the things that makes Thomas Quick quite unique, because he doesn't really show up in Johan Asplund investigation, at least early on, before his confessions.
No.
No.
But this was a very, like, well-documented case.
Yeah, and it was all over the newspapers, so everyone knew about, you know, the missing boy.
Yeah, but when the district attorney, Christer van der Kvast, when he heard that Thomas Quick confessed to this, it didn't take him very long to get on board with it, to, believe quite wholeheartedly that Thomas Quick did it.
Yeah. And I've also heard from a lot of people who have read the sentences, like, for example, the sentence for the murder of Johan Asplund, that they all come across as very convincing, because even if there wasn't really that much physical evidence, there was a lot of telling, he had a lot of information that he couldn't have had if he hadn't committed the murder.
Yeah, that is something that is reoccurring through all of the crimes, that they say he couldn't have known this if he wasn't the murderer.
Yes. And another case that is very interesting when we talk about Thomas Quick is that a case he actually wasn't convicted for, but that the police still investigated and basically came to the conclusion that he probably was the murderer, because the crime was so old that it couldn't be prosecuted anymore. It had sort of gone out of statute, I think is the term, that you couldn't prosecute it because it was done in, like, 1964.
Yes, that is the first murder. He was 14 years old, and he had gotten a ride from Falun down to Växjö. And I'm going to tell the story from Thomas Blomgren, the victim's perspective first. This boy, he told his parents that he wasn't going to be away long. And he knew that if he was out long, they would come and get him. And that was very embarrassing for a teenage boy. So he wanted to make sure that they didn't come get him. He was going out to an outdoor concert kind of thing. And he was also seen walking away from there. But once again, he never actually made it home. And his parents started worrying, they went out to see if they could find him. And then in the middle of the night, when they couldn't find him, they called the police. And it became a pretty big deal right away. People were searching for him and all of that.
Yeah, and Thomas Blomgren was found pretty soon after in a shed, as we mentioned before.
Yeah.
He had very obviously been murdered. And the one who was who had admitted this crime was then Thomas Quick, even if it was like 30 years later. And he had himself only been a boy at this time. He had been at the same age. And this case also has a number of sort of odd things about it, because Falun is pretty far from Växjö. It takes about half a day to drive.
And that fact will become more relevant later on.
Yeah, because a lot of the murders were in a sort of similar region, most of them. Most of them were in the north of Sweden, where he lived. But there were some places that were really, really, really out of the way for him to get to. So a lot of people had the idea that he must have traveled a real lot during this time.
Yeah. Well, Thomas Quick's story about his first murder was that he went to this outdoor concert. And he met Thomas there, and then he followed him. And he grabbed him from behind, and then to stop him from screaming, he kind of suffocated him.
Yeah.
His plan was to, rape him. So that's why you could actually find like grass and stuff in his pants, because the pants were down when he was murdered.
And after Thomas Blomgren, Quick just kept admitting new murders, and of course this was really interesting to the prosecution, because there were a number of unsolved murders in the north of Sweden in sort of the 80s to 90s, the interesting time period when he could have committed them. So they started to basically, compare unsolved murders in this area, could he have committed them? And one of the names of unsolved murders that popped up was Charles Selmanovic.
Yes, he was 14 years old, and he lived in Piteå.
In the very, very north of Sweden.
Yeah, I don't actually remember the year exactly.
Late 80s, I think.
Yeah, late 80s. And this is one of the cases where he actually had an accomplice. He names specifically a man called Örjan Söderlund, which was the owner of the car. They were basically out on a mission to find a boy to have sex with or to rape. If we're gonna, yeah. They were just going around, and they were looking for a place where kids would gather. And they were kind of just looking for a disco or something. And they just kind of happened to get to this place it's called Pitolmen, which is just a part of Piteå. They see a boy walking along the road. And he looks to be pretty upset. So they stop the car, and they take him into the car, and then they drive for a bit. They talk to him, and then they stop the car and start molesting him.
Yeah, and they end up beating him to death with a stick.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And after that, the accomplice again, he starts freaking out. He wasn't really. He didn't think that it would go that far. And I also think that they actually severed the head from the body.
They found his cranium later on.
Yeah, it was a very gruesome case.
Yeah, most of these cases are pretty gruesome.
But the fact is, they could never actually question Örjan Söderlund because. He had killed himself before they were linked to the murder.
Yeah.
And that could definitely be seen as an admission of guilt.
Certainly that's how a lot of people saw it.
Yeah.
At the time. And of course, when Thomas Quick had admitted all these crimes, that made him even more likely to have committed even more crimes. So they started to look at even more cases. And one very, very odd case, a murder that was committed in the absolute middle of nowhere, right out in the wilderness of the northernmost Sweden, was when a Dutch couple was found stabbed to death. And they really had no idea of who could have done it. So they went to Thomas Quick to see if he could have done it. And he admitted as well to have committed this crime.
This case was really... what do you say? It's a very random murder, even... even for Thomas Quick, it was very random.
Yeah, like they were in a tent in the absolute middle of nowhere, like as rural as you can possibly get.
And what's really horrifying is they were actually stabbed through the tent, so they didn't see who was stabbing them. They were just... stabbed with a knife, which would seem to be coming from nowhere.
And there are also some very chilling, photographs that can be seen, or video even, from reconstructions of this particular murder. Because one of the police tactics in order to investigate the murders was to bring out Thomas Quick to crime scene reconstructions that were very, very lifelike and probably sort of unconventional. I have never seen anything like that in other cases, but they were basically staging the murder, and he was given a simulated knife, and there were actors in the tent that were supposed to be the murderers, and he was supposed to show how he did it.
Yeah, and the thing was that they actually had to stop it because one of the actors became so scared.
Yeah, rightfully so, I would think. It would be weird if they weren't scared when a serial killer is having a collapse, a sort of attack when they are simulating stabbing you.
Yeah, absolutely. And once again, in this case, it was said that he gave a lot of very specific details. That would point him out as the killer.
Yeah, he knew what color the tent was. He knew where the place of the murder had happened. He knew a lot of information.
He could point out some very specific pathways that, he could draw them, and you probably wouldn't have known that if you weren't there.
Yeah, and he was also directing the vehicles when they drove to the site in order to make sure that he got there.
Yeah. And when they actually asked him why he murdered them, it's a very interesting story. Because the story is basically that they were first he and someone else was at a campsite where there were teenagers, and he saw this German boy who he decided that he wanted to have sex with, and then later on when they ran into this Dutch couple, he asked them about their son because he thought that boy was their son. And they denied having a son. And that made him so mad that he decided that he was going to kill him.
Yeah.
And that is literally all he says.
Yeah. We can probably conclude that Thomas Quick was not a man of his full senses.
If you compare to the time where he attempted murder in 73, that was also a very vicious, violent crime. And it was came out of nowhere, so clearly he does not know how to control his emotions.
Yeah. And if we move back a bit to his time at SATA, before he started committing or admitting to all these crimes, he had a quite unconventional psychiatric treatment for the time. Because SATA was seen as a very progressive hospital, very modern hospital, and they had very modern ways of treating patients, especially a woman called Norell. She had a specific theory that was connected to the Freudian theories, basically about the motives for murder, and that motives for murder could be found in early childhood memories most of the time.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And the thing is also that they believe that if something really traumatic happened to you, the memories of this could be pushed away.
Yeah.
So therefore, it didn't seem all that weird when, memories starting to reappear.
Yeah, and Thomas was also given the diagnosis multiple personality disorder. So in these psychiatric sessions, he would adapt different personas that had different personalities and different sort of ways of speaking. Like he says, for example, that one of his personas, Ellington, could speak English while his other ones couldn't. So that was also a very, very, very unique thing about Thomas is he had very, very odd psychiatric state.
Yeah, and something that I think you can actually mention is that after he admitted to murdering, after he confessed the murder of Johan Asplund, they didn't actually go to the police right away with this, which is really odd. Like, if someone tells you that they've committed murder, they actually have a responsibility to report that.
Yeah, like a lot of these admissions, the first admissions were not done to the police. They were done to psychiatrists.
Yeah.
I'm not sure
how long it went on, but it was a few months that they talked about it without actually reporting it to the police.
Yes, and they didn't, of course, since they were psychiatrists, they were not police. They took his child stories of what happened in his childhood, for example. They took them at face value. He said, for example, that he had a brother that was murdered by their parents, and he told stories of very, very graphic sexual abuse as a child.
And then these stories were used to justify, or not justify, but to explain why he went and committed the murders that he did.
Yeah, and this was part of these theories by Birgit Norell to explain the motives of these kinds of very violent killers and criminals.
Yeah, and especially because the last time that he says he was raped was when he was 13, and then when he was 14, he started killing.
Yeah.
Which they kind of describe it as when he killed that first boy, it was like he was killing himself.
Yeah. Yeah, and also connected to this psychiatric practice was also this idea of repressed memories, because this was also a thing like that was kind of in vogue in psychiatry at the time, that people could have suppressed memories so well or so successfully that they absolutely could not remember them.
Thomas Quick was first taken to Sætre, he had no memories of ever committing murders.
Yeah, and he told us much that the therapy helped him bring forth these memories. And that was also the idea of the therapy, to help him find these memories and deal with them in a way that he could live with them. And also to help, of course, the police solve these crimes. That was the idea of the psychiatry. And a few pretty unorthodox memory researchers were involved. One is called Sven-Göran Kristiansson, which has received a lot of criticism in recent days. But he had basically this idea that criminals could lock away memories so that they could not remember them in a certain way. And so he was used very much at the trial.
As you said, very controversial.
Yes. And another controversial thing about Thomas Quick's hospital stay was the amount of drugs he was given. Because he, of course, had a lot of medication since he was a deeply, deeply disturbed mental patient. He was given a number of benzodiazepines, for example, which are pretty heavy narcotics.
To be clear, also, he did have a drug problem before this. Once he ran away from the hospital just to take amphetamine, I Is that what you say?
Yeah, he had a lifelong problem with addiction as well.
Yeah.
And he started to abuse these pharmaceutical drugs as well. Also because the hospital sort of allowed him to. They gave him the ability to basically tell the personnel, now I need drugs. And they would basically give him.
Yeah, and in when they were like in therapy, if he was showing a lot of signs of anxiety, they would medicate him so that he could keep telling his story. Because, you know, when he was anxious, they saw that as, okay, now there's something really important, like just around the corner. And we have to make sure that he keeps talking. So they give him medication.
Yeah, and of course, this creates a sort of a positive feedback that when he tells, he gets drugs.
Yeah.
And this leads us to one of the things that makes this case so very unique in Swedish criminal history, but also, I think, almost world criminal history. I haven't really heard of anything like it. Because he doesn't stop confessing to crimes. He just keeps confessing to crimes.
Yeah, and one very special case was when he confessed to murdering two immigrants outside of an... What do you say?
A refugee facility.
Yeah, a refugee facility outside of Oslo, the capital of Norway. And he also admitted that he actually ate them.
Yeah, and of course the newspapers, no pun intended, ate this up and printed a lot of stories about it. And at first, he seemed very credible because he could tell exactly how the location looked, who the boys were. You know, he had a lot of details. So it seemed very likely at first. And he had already been convicted of cases in Norway at the time. So this...
Yeah, and that's when, that's when things get really weird. Because these boys were actually found alive.
Yes, a few policemen decided to, well, they were just missing, and like a lot of the time when people are missing from these kinds of facilities, they just realize they won't get asylum status and they just move somewhere else. So that was what had happened. One of the boys had moved to Sweden, and one of them had moved to Canada, but they were both still alive.
And this obviously created a question about Thomas Quick's credibility.
Yeah, because although these cases aren't as well known, he had also admitted to a bunch of other crimes that he couldn't possibly have committed. Because, like, he had murdered one person in Norway. There was a young boy called Martin, and there was no boy called Martin that had disappeared there. There were no possible, you know, no possible victim.
Yeah, but this case with the immigrant boys, this is the only time where the district attorney actually said that he doubted whether or not Thomas Quick was telling the truth. Other than that, he's been very clear about where he stands, and that is that Thomas Quick did it.
Yeah, and he also has some pretty heavy hitting lawyers and judges on his side there. But this wasn't the only case that Thomas Quick had gotten information wrong. For example, there was also another case in Norway when a young girl had disappeared called Therese Johannessen. He described her as blue-eyed and blonde and living in a rural area. But in actual fact, her father was Pakistani and she had very dark hair. And she lived in a very, very urban area, a suburb of Oslo, with rental apartments. So a lot of the information, people started to wonder, could he actually have done this? Because he was actually convicted of this case. So people started to wonder.
I mean, the facts were so off. It's like, that's not a mistake you make. You don't mistake someone with, you know, dark hair for someone blonde with blue eyes, you know. It creates a lot of questions.
And his explanation to this was pretty great, in my opinion. It was that in his head, when remembering this girl, his image in his head had become like a photo negative, so that it showed the dark hair as being light. And the people in charge did not really question this.
Yeah, I mean, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, a photo negative. We've all heard of that, right? Yeah, and so when these things came to light, a lot of people started to question, wait, look at all these cases. What is the actual evidence? Is there any physical, actual evidence that he actually committed his crimes? And this leads us to a journalist called Hannes Råstam.
Can I say something though? About in the time of like 2001, he decided that he would stop cooperating with the police. He no longer wanted to do crime reenactments or confess any more murders. He even stopped going to therapy, and he basically said, I'm not doing this anymore. And this is also at the time where he actually changes back to his birth name, Sture Bergwall. That kind of concludes the era of Thomas Quick. And after this, he doesn't actually talk to anyone, like any reporter, for about 7 years.
Yeah. And that's when he is contacted by the journalist Hannes Råstam that I mentioned before. So now we're in the year like 2006, 2007, or maybe even 2008.
I think it's 2008.
Yeah, it's around that time. And Hannes Råstam is given this, basically, okay, investigate this case. And at first, he is pretty... he doesn't really understand, you know, why does I need to investigate this? It's pretty clear, right? He is convicted of 8 murders, and I've read the sentences, and it looks like he obviously did it.
The thing that's really interesting is that the reason that he decided to do it was that he had done an investigative reporting on a case where a bunch of teenagers actually admitted to arson, even though they hadn't done it.
Yeah.
And this started this questioning in his head about false confessions.
Yeah. And when he decided to talk to Sture Bergwall, as he was now called, he was pretty shocked when he first came in to interview him, because this was, of course, Sweden's foremost serial killer, cannibal, like sadistic murderer. But he wasn't given any sort of protection when he was to go in to talk to him. He just opened the interview room, and the personnel at the mental hospital just said, okay, tell me if you need anything. And he was just sat down with him. No security glass, nothing. And that made him wonder, why are they treating him like he is absolutely no threat?
Yeah, and I think that's something that's actually goes through with like his entire treatment. They continuously treat him like he's not a threat.
Yeah, it's an interesting case of people both think that he is guilty, but treat him but also think he's not guilty at the same time, because they treat him as if he is not guilty, as if he is a very, you know, person that isn't capable of taking care of himself, and that is very sort of mild and calm, but he is also this big serial killer.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing, really.
Yeah. And of course, in a series of interviews he did with Hannes Råstam, he finally, Sture Bergwall, decided to retract all his admissions on camera in an interview.
And this was very big news, obviously.
Yeah, because now you have a lot of people that basically have built a number of murder cases mostly based on his confessions, because there was actually extremely little of physical evidence. There was no DNA, there was no fingerprints, there was nothing really like that. There were a few fragments of bone that were found in a place that Thomas Quick pointed out, but that was absolutely everything. So when he retracted his confessions, of course, this was a very, very big news for everyone involved.
Yeah.
And Hannes Råstam, he continued to investigate what had actually happened, and he also continued to interview Thomas Quick about, okay, if you didn't do this, why did you tell people you did? Why confess to a bunch of murders you didn't commit? That, if anything, that seems even more insane than the reason you're in a insane asylum.
Yeah, and his answer is pretty much that he wanted his therapist to think he was an interesting case. That he didn't think that his therapist didn't think he was interesting enough to really take on. So he started lying about things that supposedly had happened to him in his childhood.
Yeah, and his sisters and brothers and his parents, of course, when they were told about this, said, no, nothing like that ever happened. Like, nothing even close to that happened. But they hadn't really checked with anyone, because, again, they were psychiatrists. They weren't police, so they weren't really trying to investigate what had actually happened. But the police sort of took what they said at face value, which, of course, is a huge problem.
Yeah, and the thing is, when it started, when it actually became a police case, the way Thomas or Sture Bergwall describes it in the book that I'm reading, he says that he was kind of, he didn't want to embarrass his psychiatrist by retracting his statement and saying, this isn't true, I lied.
Yeah, and that's why he brought up the case of Thomas Blomberg, because he knew that he couldn't be criminally convicted of it, but he also knew that he could probably make it look like he had actually done it, so that he could still be not a liar and he wouldn't embarrass his psychiatrist, but he also wouldn't be, you know, possibly locked up in a prison.
And that, and that plus the drugs that you were talking about earlier, because this was an addict that basically found a way to get infinite drugs. Like he would confess to a murder and they would give him drugs. He would, do the crime scene reenactments, and they would give him drugs.
Yeah, and they would even let him overdose if he wanted. Like, yeah, you can have one extra.
Yeah, they even asked him how many he wanted. Like,
yeah, and it would, if you look at the journal, the doctor's charts and their notes, it just basically says give him as much as he thinks he wants. as much drugs as he wants.
What's really interesting is that at the time where he stopped cooperating, that is actually like an overlap between there was a lot of questions, and there were a lot of people who doubted his story, and the fact that he was cut off from drugs.
Yeah.
And so that's why he didn't want to do it anymore, because there was nothing for him to gain out of it.
Yeah. And if we look at how he actually managed to manipulate all these people to think he actually did it, even if we now have the motive, we don't really know how he did it. That still seems pretty difficult. But it was actually pretty easy for him. Because even if he was like on suspected of committing a bunch of murders, they still treated him as if he was harmless, because he had been at this facility for some time, even before he started confessing. So they didn't really stop treating him in that way. So he was given, you know, weekend permits, he could travel, as long as he came back, he would be unsupervised. So he would, for example, go to a library, and he would basically look up information about murders he had confessed, and he would take notes.
Hannes Råstam actually asked Sturebeva what he did when he went on a weekend permit to Stockholm. And he said that he had gone to the Royal Library, I think, and actually looked at microfilms that concerned the murder of Thomas Lundgren.
Yeah.
And the thing is that they wrote about that murder in great detail, which is why it seemed like he had to have been there.
Yeah, because it could say like, oh, it was like a shed and it had this color and everything. And of course, if you have recently read something that happened in the 60s and then they compare to what they know happened, of course, it looks very, very similar. Mm. And of course, they think, oh, he must have done it. And he was also allowed to basically to order papers to the psychiatric hospital. So people send him papers about the murders, and he basically just read those articles.
Yeah, and also the people, the original investigators of the Thomas Blomgren case, they actually said that we knew he didn't do it. The facts didn't quite add up, and they actually had a suspect that they were pretty sure did it, but they didn't have enough to actually get him convicted.
And I think the most stupid thing about all of this is that Thomas Quick had an absolutely rock-solid alibi.
Yeah.
Because he was actually confirmed the very same day that Thomas Blomgren was supposedly murdered, about 6 hours car drive away, and this was like in the 50s, and he probably didn't own a car, he couldn't drive.
No, and so basically the entire case was built on the fact that you can believe that a 14-year-old somehow can go basically 12 hours car ride just to murder someone.
And also his family doesn't wonder why he's gone.
Yeah.
From his, you know, from his big day of getting confirmed. Yeah. So there were a lot of, I would say, like, I think the police wanted to catch someone. They wanted to close these murders. And they had a confession, and they wanted to make it fit.
But again, the original investigators, they said, if we could have just talked to him, we could have caught him in a lie. We had information that was never given to the media. We could have seen that, oh, he doesn't know this. He couldn't have done it.
Yeah. And another problem is that the investigators of Thomas Quick basically treated every true statement as absolute fact and rock solid, and every lie as inconsequential, and they basically didn't even notice them.
Or sometimes they would treat the lies as, oh, the truth gives him too much anxiety. He doesn't want to tell the truth, so he tells a lie. So if he tells you that you're going to the left, it's actually the right.
Yeah. So if we would say 100 things that were wrong and one thing that was true, they would cling on to the thing that was true. And the district attorney actually admits it, shockingly, that like if he said 100 things that didn't matter and were completely untrue, and he said one thing that did fit, they would stick to the thing that fit.
The thing that I actually think is scariest about this case is that if he didn't do it, which is the common way of seeing it at this point, that means that there are a lot of murders that walked because of his confessions.
Yeah, at least 8 murderers are probably free because of these confessions, and they will extremely likely never be caught.
Yeah.
And most of them have probably died already.
And I think that's really depressing, because otherwise you could kind of almost say that it was a victimless crime. But
there were other suspects of these murders that were dropped because they had Thomas Quick, and they couldn't have got caught, but the investigation got tunnel vision, as someone put it.
Yeah, and reading these books, I read one of the books that was actually by the attorney, and I told you while I was reading it that I actually believed he did it because he was so convincing.
Yeah, and a lot of people, even people who were skeptical from the very beginning, they basically said that if you put this information in front of a jury, they would be very wrong to set him free. Because the information itself, if you're presented with it, you have to say guilty. But the problem was that the information itself was not what it seemed.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I have a problem with when someone with authority says something very confidently, and you so very brilliantly responded that that's the entire problem.
Yeah. And of course, when Studebaker had retracted all these his confessions, and this brilliant investigation by Hannes Råstam dropped, and there were documentaries where he explained how the police were fooled, how none of the evidence made sense, they basically had to bring up the cases into court again, which is extremely rare in Swedish courts. I think it had happened 6 times in the previous 100 years. So this is basically, if you have new information that is very astonishing or very convincing, like most of the time this is like you have DNA evidence that someone didn't commit a crime, or you have DNA evidence that someone else committed a crime. But in this case, he was actually able to get all his 8 convictions back in court, basically. Or not even really in court, to be honest, because when they looked through the material again and they found, okay, we can't let these convictions stand, we have to tear them up. Okay. And then the normal thing was to be, okay, we retry it. But the prosecutors basically looked at it and said, there is no evidence, so trying him again would actually be like illegal, because you can't try anyone without probable cause, and they didn't have probable cause anymore. So Sturevall was actually exonerated of all the 8 murders that he was convicted of.
And you could... Hannes Rostam actually died before Sturevall was exonerated, but you could basically say that it was because of him.
Yeah, it was very likely wouldn't have happened, because the material he went through is so astronomically big that you have to basically go through it full time for a year in order to actually find all this evidence that he found. So it was a massive workload that he managed to get through with only a few helpers. And he unfortunately died before Sturebergvall was exonerated. And Sturebergvall is actually a free man today, because he is considered mentally healthy as well.
I mean, I think if it was a more likable person, I would probably feel worse for him. But
yeah.
But the thing is, he did like rape kids.
Yeah, like, and he did try to murder someone.
Yeah, so it's like, it's not like he wasn't a great person. Like, no, he didn't murder these people, but he was still a very, like, he did have the capacity to do some really, really bad things.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that should have sort of tipped the people off is when he was actually convicted of crimes, they were really very clumsily performed. Like, he tried to rob a bank, and he was really bad at it. And he stabbed someone, and just thought they were dead, but they obviously weren't, and they were able to
the reason that he didn't get away with the robbing was that he actually used an accent for the first half of it, and then he just forgot about it and dropped it, so they recognized his voice.
Yeah, so this person had then, according to these convictions, had traveled around Sweden like a ghost, never being noticed, being able to murder at will and never be caught, and also commit an extremely clumsy robbery and get caught right away. So I would say Sturebergvall is and was a pretty repulsive person in my view. I think he probably is safe to be around now, but in any case, he should never have been convicted for these crimes.
What I find very interesting is that from my childhood, what I remember knowing about Sturebergvall is that he confessed to this crime because of drugs. I remember that, but my understanding of it was that the criminals paid him in drugs to confess for their murders.
No, it was, yeah, I think I remember something like that too, but yeah, that wasn't the case.
No, so after reading these books, it's like a very different understanding of this entire thing. And it's so ridiculous. This entire thing is so ridiculous. And yes, it is so interesting at the same time.
Yeah, like Thomas Quick was. It's an interesting way of how you basically capture the imagination of the time. People were sort of looking for a Swedish serial killer at this time, or maybe not looking for, but they wouldn't be surprised if they found one, right? So. When they finally had one, if you were to say this doesn't make sense, you were basically not to be crude about it, but you were spoiling everyone else's fun because they had a very interesting an interesting criminal to investigate. And it was very difficult to go against that stream.
Yeah.
In the very beginning. So I think that pretty much covers the trials and tribulations of Thomas Quick or Sture Bergwall. I'd like to thank you very much for doing this podcast with me. It was very interesting.
Thank you for having me.
And the sources used for this podcast has mainly been?
The case of Thomas Quick, How to Create a Serial Killer by Hannes Rosen. And Beyond All Reasonable Doubt by Christer van der Kvist.
Yeah, and there are also a couple of documentaries based on Hannes Rosen's book that are really, really good. And they're basically the book in a condensed form. You could probably find them online if you understand Swedish.
Yeah.
And there is also a book by Sture Bergwall himself. I think it's called The Man Who Stopped Lying or something like that. So, without further ado, I would like to close this episode off. I hope you have a very happy Halloween, and I'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.